Hello, everyone. This is your Captain Wade speaking. And once again, I am joined by my executive officer and co-host,
Welcome
Will.
aboard, everybody.
Good to have you back, Will. It was a great time going a little off script last time, but glad you're back,
I'm glad to
man.
be back too, and I'm glad that we can provide some escapist entertainment for everybody at the moment.
For those of you that don't know, at the time of this recording, the stay at home orders in the United States and around the world for COVID-19 are going strong. That's all we're going to say about this because we don't want to date this episode too badly.
That we've all
But
already heard enough about
so,
that from other people. So we're going to talk about ships today.
yes, and we've got a plethora of things to talk about. And in this case, it's actually a bit of a shared topic with last week's episode where we talked about maritime safety, but in the legacy of the Olympic class comes back again. You know, and this is easy for me to say because I love, love, love the Olympic class. Personally, the Olympic herself shares a number two spot right behind the SS Normandy. In terms of looks, in terms of what she meant to the maritime community at the time, the Olympic class was a jump ahead of anything that the maritime world had saw at that point. And it's interesting that the White Star Line held two of the major records in the early 20th century for largest ship on the Atlantic run, in first case with the Oceanic and then the Olympic class, the Oceanic of 1899, I should say, which is also a favorite, though it's a little quirky.
I like the Oceanic. She's a classic ship, although the funnels are really, really tall.
They apparently affected her seafaring capability a little bit, but not so much as, say, the 1948 Caronia with that massive single funnel.
Or that ridiculous eagle on the Imperator's bow.
That's true, but the Imperator got lucked out because that fell into the Atlantic somewhere. So, in any case, the Olympic class, like I said, stands a bit in a category all by themselves. But you could also argue that these ships really kicked off what you could call the size wars for the main ocean liner companies on the Atlantic trade. Because after the Olympic class, you get ships such as the Aquitania, you get ships such as the I'm trying to remember, but the ships of the Hamburg America line and Norddeutsche Lloyd.
I'm sorry, they're referred to as the Ballen Trio. So there was the Imperator, the Vaterland, and the Bismarck, and those were even bigger than the Aquitania, which herself was longer than the Olympic, although I believe the Olympic displaced more than the Aquitania. The three German ships were bigger than any of them, and that those are really kind of, you know, yet another step forward in this size race, and then eventually we got to, you know, really big ships in the 30s.
Exactly. But again, the Olympic class. And I should give credit where credit is due. The Cunard's sisters, Lusitania and Mauritania, really kicked off this race into overdrive. Now, the Olympic class, Olympic herself specifically, displaced 52,000 tons. But in terms of tonnage, she would max out after 1920 at 46,439 tons. So she is a big ship. She weighs as much as essentially an Iowa class battleship of World War II. And she was 882 feet long, which is roughly 270 meters, and a beam of 92 feet and 9 inches, which is roughly 28 meters. And this always blows me away. From her keel to the top of her, I guess, to her masts, which were technically taller than her funnels, were 175 feet. So this is a the Olympic class were tall ships, but they weren't. They were more known to be wide, and this is no accident. J. Bruce Ismay, who was the White Star Line's chairman at the time, but he was also a good friend of J.P. Morgan, who was actually the owner of the White Star Line in the sense that it was part of the International Mercantile Marine Company. Remember those guys? We mentioned that they would come back. So Ismay preferred to compete on size and economics rather than speed. And this meant that the Olympic class were not only big, but they were also meant to be, believe it or not, fuel efficient. These ships actually produced better fuel economy numbers than practically any of their contemporaries. And this was because the Olympic actually recycled her steam, not only go through these four-cylinder triple expanding reciprocating engines. These were for the outboard two propellers on the Olympic class. There was also a center smaller propeller that was powered by a steam turbine, but it was a low pressure steam turbine. Now, a low pressure steam turbine uses the recycled steam that is left over from the reciprocating engines and spins it up in that way. It's a actually very fuel efficient design because it means that you're getting more energy out of the produced steam than if just they went through the engines and then whatever excess steam would either be fed back to the condenser or out the funnels in this case. And just to correct something in this case, the Olympic only had three funnels that were connected to the engine rooms, but the fourth was not just for aesthetics. The fourth was used to basically ventilate the entire ship. Essentially, it was I guess you could say almost a proto air purification system. Not quite like that, but you got to remember that ships during this era had smoking rooms and they had massive kitchens. Well, the smoke in those two areas have to go somewhere. So that was the use of the fourth funnel. Now, the interesting thing is that because of this, the Olympic class were not as fast as their rivals. How fast were the Lusitania and Mauritania again, Will?
Mauritania, I believe, topped out around 27 or 28 knots. So they were several knots faster than the Olympic class, but the Olympic class were considered more comfortable and luxurious.
Yes, and part of that was because I believe Mauritania and Lusitania were known for being a bit of rollers. Now, when we say this, rollers are ships that will rock back and forth on their vertical axis along the ship, or their longitudinal axis, and basically it means that it produces a swaying motion on the decks. And what does that mean for passengers?
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture.
No. So in any case, the Olympic class, specifically Olympic herself, topped out in 1933 at 23 knots. But believe it or not, in 1911, during her builder's trials, she topped out at 21 knots. She actually got faster through her lifetime. So, in any case, the Olympic class were actually pretty impressive ships for their time. They had a crew of almost 1,000 and capacity for 2,435 passengers. There are cruise ships still today that don't hold that many people, though that category of people that of more people is getting bigger. But who knows? Maybe a little bit, there'll be a reversal of that trend, given what we've heard about cruise ships so far.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of, these smaller ships, which are referred to as expedition cruise ships, are starting to get popular, especially with really wealthy travelers, because they typically offer a more intimate experience and they're more efficient in a lot of ways. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be an interesting time period for the cruise industry going forward after all of this. And some people even think that, with air travel becoming increasingly damaging to the environment, that ocean liners themselves might make some sort of a comeback. It'll be interesting to see if that happens.
I'd wonder if that meant that they'd use power sources that maybe don't have to be replaced as often. I'm not suggesting nuclear, but something along those lines.
Yeah, there's some,
but
there
in
some
any case,
nuclear ideas. And the other thing, too, is I think the idea is that the pollution per passenger is a lot less on an ocean liner than it is on an airplane. Of course, the problem is that
you can fit a lot more on a ship than a plane. That's the simple economics of it.
Yeah.
So in any case, the Olympic class, of course, is famous, or I should say infamous, for two out of the three of the ships of the class sinking. Now, the Britannic, the third in the class, can't really be helped because she struck a mine. And, you know, what passenger liner could survive a mine? That's kind of an outlier in this case.
Yeah, not her
fault. But for this episode, yeah, not her fault. And, of course, it was wartime, so what can you do? But in this case, we're going to be talking about Olympic and Titanic. Of course, Titanic being the most famous slash infamous, and a lot of ocean liner fans are probably screaming that we're giving any more interest to Titanic than she already has. She is definitely the most popularly known ocean liner out there. I think we can agree on that, Will.
Definitely, yeah. I don't think any other ocean liner has a Celine Dion song about it.
Good point. Good point. Though apparently Celine Dion hates that song nowadays.
I probably would too if I had made it. It's been overplayed so much.
Yeah. And also that apparently James Cameron was a little bit of an, for lack of a better term, an asshat about her producing that song.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. I mean, directors can get big egos, but that's besides the point. In the case of the Olympic and the Titanic, you couldn't have much more opposite careers of these ships. The Titanic, of course, sinking on her maiden voyage, and the Olympic actually was a very successful liner all the way to the end of her career in 1935, after the merger of White Star Line and Cunard into a single company. And the Olympic, unfortunately, was deemed too slow and too out of date to be saved. But the interesting thing is that the Olympic and the Titanic had somewhat of a close history during their time. Now, the Olympic and the Titanic were built in the same shipyard at Harland and Wolff, which is the construction company that was very, very closely tied to the White Star Line. If I remember correctly, there was hardly a ship that the White Star Line didn't have in their fleet that wasn't built by Harland and Wolff.
Yeah, Harland and Wolff was definitely the preferred provider for them.
Yes. Now, whenever two ships are almost as identical as the Olympic and the Titanic were, at least at first glance, this is going to create some interesting things. Now, for ship fans, we understand the idea of sister ships. They're supposed to look similar to each other. But that very same similarity and what happened to Titanic afterwards during her maiden voyage has created some interesting theories about what has happened, about what could have gone on with White Star Line and the International Mercantile Marine Company, and they aren't pretty. They aren't pretty.
Everybody get your tinfoil hats ready.
Yeah, tinfoil hats is about correct. So, Will, I believe that there is one that you're well aware of, and there's one that I'm a little more well aware of. So let's start with yours
first. Sure. So this one's a doozy. So I don't even know where to begin with this one. It is one of the most elaborate and outlandish conspiracy theories I have ever heard of. And this is the infamous and thoroughly debunked, before we get any further with this, RMS Titanic, RMS Olympic switch theory. Okay. So this all go and Wade mentioned that these two ships were almost identical. And the answer, the important operating word here is almost. They weren't completely identical. There were little differences, especially in the window arrangements on the two different ships. So they, you know, they weren't identical twins, but they were pretty darn close. And before the Titanic had her maiden voyage, RMS Olympic had a collision with a Royal Navy cruiser, the HMS Hawk. And the Hawk was, like other warships of her day, equipped with a ram bow. And we'll talk about why that is in our next episode. But the upshot of this was that her ram bow was specifically designed to cause serious damage if she hit something. And she did. So the Olympic took some serious damage from this and was forced to cancel her voyage and be repaired. Well, she ends up returning to service. And as Wade mentioned, had a very long and successful career after that. Although she did seem to have a penchant for hitting things, because she also rammed and sank the Nantucket lightship later in her career. So,
yeah,
you know, these ships did run into things a lot. But anyway, the theory is that she was actually more seriously damaged in this collision with the Hawk than anybody let on. And to recover the costs, the White Star Line needed a big insurance payout. And basically, the theory alleges that the Titanic and the Olympic were essentially switched at birth, so to speak, that the second ship that was built was actually renamed the Olympic, and then the original Olympic was renamed the Titanic, and then the quote-unquote Titanic, which was actually the Olympic, was purposefully sunk in order to get an insurance payout for a undamaged new ship, which would be more than an insurance payout for a damaged older ship. You guys confused yet? Okay. So anyway, that's the theory. And this was put forward by this guy named Robin Gardner in this book called Titanic, the Ship That Never Sank? So he cited all kinds of various pieces of evidence for this, which we'll go into and then debunk. But before we do that, it's important to note that the idea of sinking ships purposefully as insurance scams is actually not that outlandish, because that has happened. Usually not with ships that are actively in service. It's usually ships that are retired and are being towed to the scrapyard that mysteriously sink. I think there's been something like 45 or 50 retired ocean liners that over the years have sunk on their way to the scrapyard. And of course, it's always officially an accident because they can get the insurance payout for it, but it's always a little convenient. Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of, there is some precedent for an insurance scam of that type. But there's a lot of reasons why this theory doesn't, sorry for the incoming bad pun, hold any water. So, one of the, there's several reasons that Robin Gardner talks about for this. One of them is he claims that the Titanic's insurance value, and when I say Titanic, just to make it clear, we're talking about the actual Titanic. You know, we're going to keep these ships with their real names for the rest of this discussion. The claim is that the Titanic's insurance value was increased 5 days before the maiden voyage. Because of this, she ended up receiving $12.5 million of insurance payout to everybody's favorite, you know, robber baron J.P. Morgan for this. And so people look at this and go, oh, my gosh, they knew what they were going to do. They, you know, they deliberately increased the insurance value. But the fact is that actually she was still undervalued by $2.5 million at that point. So if they had actually, you know, increased the value, they would have increased it to the full actual value of the ship if they were really planning to scuttle it. One of the other things that people pointed out is that that one of the conspiracy theories, as I mentioned, is that the collision with the Hawk caused more damage to the Olympic than people let on. And so the theory is that she actually received keel damage from this. There's no actual evidence for that. All the accounts, and especially some very well-researched books that have come out recently, have indicated that the damage was mostly superficial and was able to be repaired. Gardner, in his book, said, well, how could the Olympic have such a long and successful career after being that seriously damaged? One of the more intriguing things, when I first heard about this theory, I did think it was kind of interesting, but you know, we didn't really get taken in. One of the things that was kind of interesting is that the Olympic did have a 2-degree list to port in some pictures. And it was claimed that this was due to keel damage from the Hawk collision. That's not actually the case. But the Titanic herself also had a similar list. And so people were like, oh my gosh, it's actually the Olympic. It's the same list. The fact is that most ships listed a couple of degrees back then for various reasons. And it usually had to do with the way that the ballast was arranged inside the ship. They also claim that only a few things would be needed to be changed between the ships. You just swap out the nameplates and you're good to go. That's not really true because, as we mentioned, there were some structural differences between the two ships. The Titanic had a different window arrangement on her superstructure than the Olympic, and that would be exceptionally difficult to fix. However, one thing that was kind of interesting was that in launching photos of the Titanic, she has 14 portholes on her forecastle area. The ship that is on the bottom of the Atlantic right now has 16 portholes on her forecastle area. And it was known that the Olympic had 16 portholes in her forecastle area. So when people first heard about this, some people, especially Garden, went, aha. Well, the fact is that when they look back at the records, the Titanic, after she was launched, was then modified and given 2 extra portholes on her bow to match her sister ship because it allowed for better ventilation. So that's not actually a reason to be concerned. One of my favorite outlandish pieces of this was apparently the Titanic's nameplate is different between her launching photo and a later picture, that the letter T is positioned differently between 2 of the portholes. When they did some more zoomed in research on the original picture, it turned out that's because the name Titanic was actually written on the negative in that photo. It was not actually on the ship itself. It was basically Photoshop, 1912 style. So, that is out of the picture. One of the really crazy ones is they claim that, I guess, every other ship in the White Star Line fleet had embossed nameplates on their bow, but the Titanic's letters were riveted on instead. And so people thought that was kind of odd. And then the really nutty one is, I guess they were looking at photos of the Titanic's bow at the bottom of the Atlantic. And there was a claim that was made using, I believe, Microsoft Paint to trace out these alleged letters, that a couple of the letters had fallen off and underneath were the embossed letters MP, from Olympic. That has also pretty much been debunked. So there's a whole bunch of other various little things in there about this that are really kind of wild. One of my other favorites is they claim that there was a room on the Titanic somewhere called the Olympic Room. And there is a kind of a superstitious legend among the seafaring community that it's bad luck to change the name of a ship. And so the story goes that J.P. Morgan made sure that there was still a room called the Olympic Room to kind of ward off some of the bad luck from changing the name. The problem with that theory is that there actually wasn't a room called the Olympic Room on the Titanic. Like, everybody looked at the plans in a lot of detail and there was no such room. So a lot of these pieces of evidence that have been used to support this theory are pretty much completely fabricated. The biggest thing that people point out is kind of weird is that J.P. Morgan himself was supposed to sail on the Titanic's maiden voyage, and then he canceled his trip at the last minute. And so some people are like, he knew. And this also plays into another theory that's kind of related to this one, which is that J.P. Morgan actually sank the Titanic on purpose because he was trying to drown several of the other bankers that were on the ship who were opposed to the creation of the Federal Reserve, which apparently was J.P. Morgan's brainchild, was to create the Federal Reserve. And so he basically murdered John Jacob Astor IV, Benjamin Guggenheim, and Isidore Strauss, who were these guys on the Titanic who were opposed to the central bank. That's really getting kind of a stretch in terms of the credibility of this theory. But that's one of the ideas that has been cited for why Morgan deliberately sank the ship. One of the other really crazy parts of the conspiracy theory that I heard is that the Titanic didn't actually even hit an iceberg. Somebody claimed that the jolt everybody felt was actually a black painted ship that had been sent in to ram the Titanic and sink her and then leave, and that the ice that was on the deck had been scraped off of this black ship's rigging when she hit the Titanic. Anyway, you can come up with all kinds of kooky stuff for this, you know, to justify this idea. But the bottom line is that it's pretty much impossible that this actually happened. This is a well debunked theory. The Olympic is actually the Olympic. You know, if you ever are interested in learning more about this, there's a website called TitanicSwitch.com, which essentially point by point goes through this theory and takes it out. This website also points out that, you know, I mentioned earlier about the nameplates being riveted on. That was made up. It was completely made up. The names were not riveted on. They were embossed on both of the ships as they were on all of the other White Star ships. They found that on the wreck. The other piece of evidence for this is that there is, believe it or not, there is a remaining piece of White Star heritage still around, and that is the Tender Nomadic, which is still a museum ship. She was built basically to ferry passengers to and from the Olympic and the Titanic. And lo and behold, she also had an embossed nameplate. So anyway, I could run through all of the various different pieces of this theory and debunk all of them. We would be here a while if I did that. But suffice it to say, this is certainly an entertaining conspiracy theory, but it's not true. And just goes to show people will believe anything.
And here's something, Will, that I don't know if you know already, but here's something that as someone who's had to remodel two basements will tell you, this is something that you could not repair or fix in just, say, a week or two's time, which is what they would have had at this point. Mm-hmm. Now, the Titanic had what was called Axminster carpeting in her public rooms. Which is, Axminster is just the brand of carpeting that they were using. It's a British brand. But on the Olympic, you used linoleum. They used linoleum on the public rooms of the Olympic. Mm. Now, in this case, with flooring, you cannot lay carpet on top of linoleum. You can't. It is... if it does, it's going to lose grip practically without warning, and you're going to have people slipping and sliding all over the place. It has to be sealed to the actual subfloor, in this case, the steel structure of the ship.
Yeah.
So that's just a little bit there that says if the ship had that's sitting at the bottom of the Atlantic had linoleum public rooms, yeah, maybe there would be something to this. But obviously carpet isn't going to last very long in water if it's just the bare metal, which it is at this point, or rust, basically, at this point. It's not the Olympic.
It's not.
Get that through your heads, people.
The other thing that's really now, I forgot to mention, is that I guess the promotional materials for the Titanic when she was first launched, like all the brochures and stuff, all of the interior photos were actually interior photos of the Olympic. And so people are like, look, they're trying to fool everybody so that when they go on the Titanic, you know, it'll look right. The simple reason is that they already had press photos of the very similar interiors of the Olympic and just decided to use those. You know, it's not. And the other little thing with the Titanic's wreck, I don't know if you guys heard, but recently, one of the United States Navy's illustrious submarines hit the Titanic. At least that's what I heard. I'm going to have to, you know, check into that a little bit more. But, you know, the story continues with things hitting Olympic class ships. It just never ends.
Yeah, it doesn't end. And also, this is something that we should mention. Harlan and Wolff, the shipbuilder that is responsible for the Olympic class, and a lot of White Star Line's ships, they are the White Harlan and Wolff had somewhat of a habit of transferring design language from one ship to another.
Yeah.
In fact, it was almost to the point that it was ridiculously carbon copied. Mm-hmm. And this was even for ships that were not designed by by Harlan and Wolff. When Harlan and Wolff got their hands on the German ship Homeric, it was known as the Columbus back in Germany, but when it was brought as a war reparation to Britain, it was renamed the Homeric, and its interiors, which were built by Harlan and Wolff, well, basically they had to gut the ship, basically, but its interiors are Harlan and Wolff, and they look a lot like the Olympic class. It was just the way they did it.
Yeah, I just learned that my great-grandpa, I knew that he had served in the Allied Expeditionary Force to Siberia during the Russian Civil War. Turns out the ship...
Hey, my great-grandpa was there.
No kidding. Maybe they were...
Yeah.
Huh. We'll have to look into that a little bit more. Anyway...
Archangel Russia.
Okay. My great-grandpa was on the other side. He was at Vladivostok.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, but maybe they were... I don't know. That's interesting. But anyway, the ship that he sailed over on, the USAT Logan, Army transport ship, was built by none other than Harlan and Wolff. So anyway, interesting stuff.
Yeah. So in any case, there's a slightly different part to the switch theory that does have to be said. Unfortunately, it wasn't just the collision with the Hawk that conspiracy theorists love to point to. There was also, and this did happen with the Titanic, she accidentally had a bunker fire in her. Now, I should say what a bunker is. In the case of a ship, a bunker is where the fuel is stored for a ship. In the case of the Olympic class, up until post-World War I, that was coal. Now, the thing about coal is that it burns relatively slowly and relatively coolly. It's not a very hot burning material unless you lay it out just right. That's why on steam locomotives, you had a fireman who would lay out the coal just right so that it would burn nice and hot so that it would boil the water, of course, and produce steam. Now, you had firemen on the Olympic class, as with other steam-powered vessels that used coal. So the thing is that if a the conspiracy theorists would say that the Olympic suffered damage from this fire, again, keel damage, basically. Again, I'm not exactly sure how that is because the bunkers were often on the sides of the ship, well away from the keel. So we're going to put that out there right now.
They would just go really far in to even get to the keel, but yeah.
Exactly. So the bunker was caught on fire, but they were able to suppress the fire. Now, the only evidence that they say that there was structural damage to this is a dark spot on a picture of RMS Olympic in 1912 when she's being repaired, when she's still being repaired from the Hawk's damage. And unfortunately, this is a problem with black and white photography. Because we see things in color, we apply that to anything that we see, whether it is in color or not. So people said, oh, look at that, that's damage from it. Nah, it's just a shadow from the flare of the bow, basically. And this is hard to tell because it's a black and white picture. So shadow and damage can actually look very, very similar from the distance that you would have to get to capture the whole bow of the Olympic. Because remember, this is a big ship. You can't just stand right next to it and expect to get a good shot. So that's a second part to the switch theory. Again, you know, insurance money, sinking it. Now, I can't say that that J.P. Morgan was going to use the same tactic of eliminating his rivals, but
yeah, that's one of the crazier ones. Like, let's just take out the Astors by sinking my own ship.
It's like this is the part about ocean liner history that really makes it, because of course, you've got the luxury, you've got the class, you've got the brave stories, but you've also got a little bit of the crazy. And we talked about that with the cannon shot heard around the world. Sailors are sometimes not the most stable, I guess. I'll put it that way.
And that continues to this day. I don't know if you heard about this, but 3 days ago, there was a naval battle involving a cruise ship in the Caribbean, and where I guess this cruise ship called the Resolute was, I kid you not, doing engine repair work 13 miles off of the island of Tortuga, okay, of Pirates of the Caribbean fame, when it was approached by a Venezuelan gunboat, which was operating under the assumption that it was there for nefarious purposes and was intending to help overthrow President Maduro of Venezuela, who, as we know, is involved in a dispute for, you know, control of the Venezuelan government. The gunboat then proceeds to order the cruise ship to follow it back to Tortuga and be interned by the Venezuelan Navy. The cruise ship, which is, I believe, Danish-owned, I think, or German-owned, one of those countries, refuses to comply. And so instead, the gunboat proceeds to ram the cruise ship. Sounds a little bit like the Hawk, except on purpose. The problem is that this gunboat is very cheaply built, and this cruise ship was Finnish-built with a ice-breaking bow. What ends up happening is said gunboat sinks. The cruise ship is almost entirely unscathed, and thus this cruise line, Columbia Cruise Holdings Incorporated, has won a naval battle against the Venezuelan Navy 3 days ago. So crazy stuff involving collisions and cruise ships continues to happen.
Yes. Okay, that's got to be one of the better stories I've heard in the last few weeks, I have to say. So in any case, another interesting bit about the relationship between the Titanic and the Olympic. Now, Captain Edward Smith, who was the Titanic's commanding officer during that fatal voyage, was commanding officer of the Olympic during the Hawk collision. The stewardess Violet Jessop,
poor Violet,
who is famous, who has she also. She's famous for have survived the sinking of the Titanic and the sinking of the Britannic. She also survived this collision. So I don't know if the Olympic was just lucky or what have you, but there was definitely something going on there.
I'm sure she probably never wanted to set foot on a White Star ship ever again after that.
After the Britannic, definitely.
It's like, that's it. Yeah. I'm done.
Yeah. And that will be a topic for the next episode, for another episode, how the White Star line kind of follows on this downward spiral after the loss of two of their three Olympic class ships, and also the mismanagement by Ismay and Morgan through the International Mercantile Marine Company. We're not done with those guys yet. I guarantee I am going to rip a new one on JP Morgan. Because even if he wasn't responsible, like Will said, for this murder of his associates,
enemies,
or business enemies, he was still, he was a captain of industry in the early 20th century. Yeah. They're not exactly known for their compassion.
No. They certainly are not.
No. And except for Andrew Carnegie. I will give him credit.
He was an exception. He was a good guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just so you know, guys, whenever you hear Carnegie Library, that was done with the Andrew Carnegie fortune, basically. So if you have that, have one of those in your hometown. That was Andrew Carnegie. So I think we can at least thank him for that.
Yeah.
But in any case, the ultimate thing that I want you all to take away from this is that the Olympic class, again, lots of conspiracy theories. Don't believe them. Don't believe them. So history has run as it should have. Now, I will be eternally sad that the Olympic herself met her end in somewhat the disgraceful way she did. But she had a long career.
She did. And people pointed out that her scrapping did provide jobs to a lot of people at the Gero Works who needed them during the Depression. So in a way, you could say that even in her final moments, she was serving her country. And she certainly had a long and distinguished career.
Yes. And I think we can leave it at that.
Yeah.
I think we could take off our tinfoil hats and stuff them in the trash.
So, for our next episode, we will be traveling to the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary. So stay tuned.
Yes. And if you have comments, questions, or critiques, or possible guests for our show, our email is attached to the description of this episode. And with that, I will say fair winds and following seas to you all.